He couldn't breathe, couldn't move, his lungs locked up. Jovencito was on his knees, staring down. The scalpel had embedded itself in his side at the base of his torso, likely between the 8th and 9th ribs, right through the intersection of the tattooed pendant cross. Too low for the heart, too shallow to puncture a lung. The cutting edge had gone in only an inch or so, the handle dangling out like a dart sunk poorly into a corkboard. He stared down at it in disbelief, his injured hand hovering over it, too stunned to yank it out. Evan needed the intermission himself. He opened a channel of air, a screeching sip of oxygen working through the contorted muscles of his left side, and then he managed to heave himself forward on the floor to kick the bottom of Jovencito's hand. The glass-crusted palm flew up, smacking into Jovencito's right eye, and he bellowed, finding his feet. For an instant he swayed above Evan and then tumbled backward, his shoulders crashing against the base of the wall across the suite. They lay there, panting, recovering strength. Aside from their heaving chests, they barely moved, but their eyes remained locked on each other. Jovencito's right socket was lost beneath a wash of blood, a glittering crimson eye patch. The scorched flesh of Evan's neck stung, and his elbows simmered from tile burn. The room stank, a haze of rubbing alcohol, conductive gel, and blood hanging in the air. More commotion from outside the door. A shout, and then a round cracked off the sturdy surgical door, followed by the whine of a ricochet. Evan tried to unkink his left side, but the muscles weren't listening, fibers and tendons kneading tighter. On the plus side, he was getting some air into his lungs, and his right arm mostly worked. Angelina had backed behind the exam table, wielding the metal stirrup before her like a baseball bat. She'd managed to pull on her jeans, and her shirt was half on, her belly exposed. Using his legs and the muscles of his right side, Evan rolled himself up into a sitting position. Across the room, Jovencito did the same. Like boxers trying to find their feet, they moved to all fours, straining to stand. They crawled toward each other. Jovencito stood first, kicking out Evan's arm. Evan's chest slapped the floor. With his right hand, he reached into the mound of scalpels next to him, miraculously not catching an edge. Jovencito stooped, picking up the base unit of the defibrillator and hoisting it overhead, readying to bring it down on Evan's skull. Angelina hurled the stirrup, but it flew wide over Jovencito's shoulder, spinning end over end before crashing into the wall. Giving Evan the split-second opening he needed to jab a scalpel through the bottom of Jovencito's calf. Jovencito grunted, dropping the unit, which glanced off his cheek as it fell, knocking him down. Evan pressed the advantage, dragging himself atop Jovencito and pounding his face with his right fist. No Hapkido, no Muay Thai, no Shotokan, just wailing away with what little he had left. That scalpel still drooped from between Jovencito's ribs, out of reach, and Evan didn't dare stop swinging to go for it. Jovencito managed a throat strike, Evan reeling away from the pressure, choking, the younger man atop him now, fingers digging for his eyes. Evan bucked, and they slammed over into a skein of glass shards, smearing a confusion of blood on the floor beneath them. Jovencito's Kyocera phone had spilled out of his pocket and gotten smashed to pieces in the fray. Jovencito punched Evan's left ribs once, twice, the already contracted muscles screaming. Evan moved with the next blow, Jovencito tumbling, Evan on top of him once more, fastening his hands around his throat, choking him out. Losing oxygen, Jovencito slapped at Evan's face, weaker, weaker. But Evan's left hand was cramping, a line of fire intensifying down that whole flank. The nodding came up from his ribcage, claiming his shoulder, his biceps, forearm. Jovencito was purpling, fatiguing. But so was Evan. His left hand was aflame, cramped into uselessness, and he had to let go, fingers clawing. He collapsed onto Jovencito, the men lying spent, chest to chest, face to face. Jovencito coughed himself back to life as Evan tried to shake feeling back into his left side. Jovencito slid his forearm beneath Evan's throat, grabbed Evan's hair, and ripped his head forward and down, grinding Evan's windpipe into the hard edge of his ulna, cutting off oxygen. Evan could feel the younger man's breath on the top of his head. He could sense Angelina in his peripheral vision, terrified, gathering her nerve to come forward. Given what Jovencito had overheard, Evan had to gain the upper hand and get her out of here, or Montesco would slice her to pieces. No air in or out. Jovencito overpowering him, cinching off his breath. Evan's vision tunneled, crowding in at the edges, face on fire. If he died, she'd die. It seemed headed that way. Evan groped for anything on the floor, but came up empty. His vision compressing, a shrinking point of light. Their bodies were too close for Evan to get at Jovencito's groin, his stomach. His right hand slid up Jovencito's side, grasping for anything. Struck metal. The protruding scalpel. With the last of his strength, Evan fastened his hand around it and drove it inward. Jovencito screamed, an ungodly high wail. Evan dug it farther inward, then upward, felt a lung pop. Jovencito let go of the chokehold, flinging them onto their sides, grabbing Evan's wrist with both his hands to stop the scalpel's progress. Evan's fist, wrapped around the end of the scalpel, froze in place, trapped in the push-pull. Willing life into his clawed left hand, Evan forced it open into an insensate slab of flesh and drew it back. For a moment, his flattened palm hovered high over the union of their three hands. Then he hammered it down, striking the butt of his own fist, driving the scalpel into Jovencito. The point slid up and through the thoracic cage. Jovencito arched back onto heels and shoulders as if struck by lightning and shuddered violently with equine vigor. Evan's muscles gave out with fatigue, and he slumped down on Jovencito's body. His cheek rested on the Sicario's chest, vibrating with each labored thump of the dying heart. Evan's head rose and fell with Jovencito's last heaving breaths. The sound of the heartbeat against Evan's ear grew slower. 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 A last whistle leaked through Jovencito's teeth as he deflated, and then his head rolled up and sideways. Evan lay on the body in exhausted stillness. Then he drew himself up. There was a horrible screech, and it took a moment for him to realize it had escaped his own mouth. Angelina stared at him, lips agape, then rushed to him and caught him as he stumbled. "The window," he said. "Need to break the window and go." "No," she said. "We can't." "We have to go. We can get out. I can protect you." "He'll kill him. He'll kill Raimundo." "It doesn't matter. We can't," she said. "I can't. I won't." The horde at the door banged away, the reinforced metal thundering in its frame. Her shirt was still stuck up above her belly, the slope of brown skin protruding. He could barely breathe, the left half of his torso in full spasm from his armpit to his waist. His left hand was still cramped beyond comprehension, and he straightened the fingers, flexing it, pins and needles creeping beneath the skin. "Please," she said. "I don't know what I'd do without him." She took Evan's trembling hand and placed it on her belly. Her skin, so smooth, so warm, and then the faintest pulse of movement beneath. He looked up into her face, limped across to the door, and unlocked it. Chapter 43. A Special Relationship with Pain. Before Evan could cross the threshold, he was greeted with a faceful of muzzles. 44s and MP7s rammed at his head like a bouquet of microphones from a clamoring press. "Get El Moreno on the phone," he barked. "Now!" Nacho jabbed the MP7 at his chin. "Who the fuck do you think?" Evan swatted the barrel aside. "I found the mole. Call him now!" "Where's Jovencito?" another of Montesco's men shouted out. "You guys are a slow study," Evan said, shouldering through them, keeping Angelina at his back. There was a throng of onlookers, doctors, nurses, the chief of staff, and a smattering of patients. Some of the men moved into the surgical suite, exclamations and swear words ringing out. The remaining men hesitated but didn't lower their guns. They stayed shoulder to shoulder, blocking Evan's way out. The chief of staff rubbed his hands nervously.
"Perhaps you could resume this conversation out—"
"No one's going anywhere," Nacho said. "We have to move," Evan said. "If Jovencito knew we were here, there's probably a team of Gulf Cartel assassins en route already." The men exchanged glances. With Jovencito gone, they weren't sure who to listen to. Grimacing against the pain, Evan started forward, but Nacho stepped in front of him. "I've known Jovencito for years. Why the fuck would we believe you?" He raised the slung MP7 once more, aiming at Evan's chest. "Step away from the girl." The others stirred, encircling Evan and Angelina. He couldn't push the ruse any further. It was hard for him to project strength when half his body was barely functioning. He'd hit a dead end and was in no condition to fight his way out. A feminine voice broke through the periphery. "I heard him." They pivoted to face Dr. Ortega. "The Sicario," she said. "When I came out to get the ultrasound cart, he was up the hall there." She pointed to a brief hall leading to the bathrooms. "I heard him calling in the location here to someone. His back turned, voice low. I remember thinking it was odd he was telling someone you were all here, when it was made clear to us to keep this visit confidential." Montesco's men shifted on their feet, studied Evan. Ortega's lie had set them on edge, injecting the right amount of doubt at the right time. Suddenly their eyes looked wider, their expressions worried. What reason would a doctor have to cover for Evan? And yet the muzzle of Nacho's MP7 stayed where it was, aimed at Evan's heart. One of the henchmen shouldered to the front, lowering a phone from his ashen face. "The forest lab's been raided," he said, "burned to the ground." Wordless agitation circled the men. A freighted pause. And then the MP7 lowered. Evan let out his breath slowly through clenched teeth. Nacho turned, rushing for the exit. "Let's go." Evan limped after them, Angelina looping an arm around his waist to hold him upright. As they passed by, Dr. Ortega gave the faintest dip of a parting nod. The chauffeur drove Nacho, Evan, and Angelina back to the estate, Evan doing his best to breathe through his seized-up left side. In the back seat, he and Angelina stared out opposite windows. Not a word exchanged. His neck burned, hands sore from the failed strangulation, his chest tight and pinched as from a tension pneumothorax, of which he'd had three, including one he'd had to self-puncture with a bicycle pump needle in a mechanic shop outside Ankara. In the passenger seat, Nacho made a series of calls but was unable to reach Montesco, who was evidently somewhere dealing with the aftermath of the assault on the forest lab. From this end of Nacho's conversations, Evan gleaned that the lab had been taken down by a DEA Policía Federal Ministerial joint raid, which meant that Aragon had delivered on his promise to forward intel about the contact supply chain to the authorities. The pieces were there for Evan to stitch this all together into a narrative he could sell to Montesco. But the pain was intense enough to prevent him from figuring it out now. He'd have to unstick his body first. And in the meantime, keep respirating. Back at the estate, Darling Boy greeted them at the front door, twirling his combat knife around the back of his hand and catching it again like a baton. Given the look of unmitigated hatred he leveled at Evan, it was clear that news of Jovencito's demise had reached the grounds. It would be up to the Dark Man to decide whether to believe Evan or not. Raimundo rushed into the foyer and embraced Angelina.
"You're okay?"
"Yes," she said. "Thanks to him." Raimundo took in Evan, ripped clothes, bloodstains, painfully contorted posture, and said, "Thank you." Two simple words, but there was a universe of gratitude behind them. Evan gave a nod. When Raimundo helped Angelina off to her room, Darling Boy moved to stop him.
"I'll take her,"
She's bearing El Moreno's grandson, Evan said. You'd best let her do what she wants. Darling Boy's lips twisted in disdain. But he didn't object. He stuck out an arm, letting the couple lead the way, and then followed them tightly. Angelina was smart enough not to look back at Evan. Wobbling on his feet, Evan took a moment to set his balance. The left side of his torso was locked up badly enough that he had trouble walking. His foot dragged as he passed down the narrow hallways, guards watching him impassively, grenade pouches at their belts. He barely made it to his bedroom suite, heeled the door shut behind him, stood on the lush carpet, breathed the still, private air. Now, finally, he allowed the pain all the way in. It came in a rush, robbing his breath, the entire side of his body stitched up from hip to shoulder, knotted with Charlie horse intensity. Certain people, victims, athletes, the terminally ill, find a special relationship with pain. Evan had been taught by Jack Johns and subject matter experts how to understand it intimately. Some injuries have to be identified early, others ignored. There are those that can be put off for a while, and the ones that announce in real time that you will carry them to the end of your days. This was none of them. An excruciating but non-permanent impairment brought on by a vicious beating and 1,000 volts passed through the major muscle groups of half his torso. He did not have time to let it heal slowly, to coax the muscles into relaxing over the course of a few days. Locating the thermostat, he clicked the heat to high, the vents firing immediately overhead. He searched for an appropriately heavy book on the shelves, found a Spanish translation of Crime and Punishment, jacketless and upside down. Nice and sturdy, the size of a yoga block. As he plucked it out, he noticed his torn knuckles, Jovencito's dried blood speckling the back of his hand. He lowered himself to the carpet, groaning as his weight tugged him down the last few inches. For a moment, he lay flat on his back, gathering his nerve. Then he planted his feet and lifted his hips, sliding the book beneath his sacrum. Grimacing, he lowered his pelvis again. The supported bridge was the best position for him to check the infrastructure of his spine, assess what was going on and what he needed to do. Right now, he couldn't do anything except breathe. If he could slow the breath down, that would tell his body it was safe. Time after time, the pain objected, but time after time, he rerouted it to a different corner of his mind. Despite a stubborn hitch at the bottom of his exhalations, he made headway. He held his breath for a 10 count to reset his nervous system again, and when he exhaled, the air moved smoothly all the way out. Removing the block, lowering his hips, he gave himself a 30-second reward of stillness. Rolling to his stomach caused more pain than seemed humanly bearable, a cattle prod jolt up to his brain. The heat of Nuevo León, augmented by the HVAC unit, felt infernal. Perspiration sprang up in beads on his arms, drained off his flanks. Face down, toes touching, heels falling to the sides, palms stacked beneath his forehead. He told himself that this pain was nothing more than the space between needing to release and actually releasing. He'd been trained to close that gap a millimeter at a time. Right now, his training didn't mean a fucking thing. Right now, the pain needed to have its say. He let it. There was no choice. For a time, it ravaged him. He kept trying for the breath and finally found a version of it that wasn't so ragged as to be unrecognizable. Loosening. 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 Pressing his right cheek to the carpet, he cactused his arms and slid his left knee up beside him, keeping the inner seam of the leg pressed flat to the floor. Half frog pose, like a chalk outline prone on the floor. He was making noises he didn't recognize, panting, spent, But now, he was here. This was the pose he needed to loosen his left side. As he was taught years ago, he visualized each bundle of fibrous tissue, picturing each tendon and ligament so he could breathe into them and restore them to laxity. He started with the superficial layers. The tightened muscle resisted, and finally yielded, a sensation like interlaced fingers pulling slowly apart. Then he moved to the deeper layers, opening them up slowly, one at a time. Sweat dripped onto his lashes. He blinked it away. He was panting, his mouth cotton. He tried to relax everything. Toes, jaws, the space between his eyes. Detaching muscle from fascia, bone from ligament, letting them sag weightlessly. His body nothing more than a sack of skin and fluid. He let his bones settle to the bottom and held the pose for 5 minutes. 7. Felt a hip flexor roll across the iliac crest and pop over the bone, a tug he felt all the way up in his ear canal. He was sobbing soundlessly, and it wasn't grief. It was the pain shuddering through the channel of his body as it exited, striking ancient chords. Backhanded by the mystery man, laid out on a handball court at the age of 12, fished out of a pool during drown-proofing training in his early teens, lungs filled with water, writhing in shards of broken glass in a lampshade shop in Gaza, twisting beneath a Syrian rebel, his hands aching around the handles of a garrote. He was in all ages of himself all at once, the pain compounding through his muscle memory like an echo, a Russian nesting doll, a hall of mirrors. When the pains past and present aligned, they reached an unsustainable altitude, knocking him clear out of his body. Jack was there, squinting his baseball catcher's squint, arms folded, staring down at him. He looked unimpressed, but that was just Jack's face. "We don't rise to the level of our aspirations," Jack said. "We fall to the level of our training." Through gritted teeth, Evan forced out words. "Who's that?" "I think Archilochus, Greek poet."
"He the fox and hedgehog guy?"
"The very one." Jack eyed him. "He looked like a monkey trying to hump a football."
"The pain's pretty good."
"We have to heal ourselves every day, or else we're just dying."
"Helpful," Evan grunted. "You just show up to lend the moral support of ancient thinkers?"
"Modern ones, too."
"What you got in that category?"
Jack pondered a moment. "What we resist pursues us. What we accept transforms us."
"Who said that?"
"Aren't you listening, son?" That almost smile, the one that crinkled his eyes at the edges.
"I just did."
Evan came back into himself. He had perspective on the pain, could see it for what it was, even feel gratitude for how it was trying to protect him. His hip opened wider. His heart melted into the carpet. It was like he was hugging the floor and it was hugging him back. He felt good. Strong. Sliding himself up to all fours, he took Balasana, a knees-together version of child's pose, third eye to the earth, arms stretched behind him, palms facing up, puddled over the curled stack of his body as if he'd been poured into the shape, thighs pressing into his chest, his back bowed, spread wide beneath the painted heaven above. The muscles slackened around his vertebrae, a freeing sensation like pulling a shoelace through the eyelets of his spine. Loose on the bone, braised meat ready to slough free. He drew in a diaphragmatic breath that filled his entire body and released it with a single sharp exhalation. As his body sank, it folded vertically around the center line of his thighs and spine, and his back cracked all the way from sacrum to shoulders. He stood up. Fresh blood rushed into the points of compression. No pain anywhere. Just a soft, lovely ache that reminded him he was alive. He shook out his neck, let his hands snap back and forth on his wrists. Everything realigned. He was ready, his sixth sense humming to life again. His gaze tracked to the door a moment before it opened. El Moreno entered. Chapter 44. What I Do. Before Montesco could enter the room, Evan said, "Congratulations." Montesco halted, his hair jumbled across his eyes. He stank of body odor and cigarette smoke, his skin shiny with sweat. From the look of it, he'd had a longer day than Evan had. He mopped at his forehead but did not comment on the roasting room temperature. "My sicario is dead," he said, "and the Federal a la Verga took out my biggest production facility. So what are you congratulating me about?" "You're having a boy." At this, the dark man paused, rolled his lips over his teeth, released them with a popping sound. "Your name will continue on," Evan said, well after the noise of any given day. "That's why Raimundo is with her now. Without my approval?" "You can do whatever you want," Evan said, "but that baby needs to grow healthy and strong. He will need his father there just as Raimundo needed you." Montesco took this in for a moment solemnly, weighing it in his mind. Then he padded across the carpet, snapped off the thermostat, and sat on the bed, pulling the sheets out of alignment. "Jovencito, talk." He placed a call in the hallway, then came in, pulled his pistol to shoot the girl. "I did what I do." At this, Montesco grinned a wolfish grin. "The Gulf Cartel doesn't just want you dead," Evan said. "They want your lineage snuffed out." Montesco looked haggard, dark skin sagging beneath his eyes. "Darling boy found irregularities in the bank accounts of three of my men here." "Payments from the Gulf Cartel?" "That was unclear." "What did you do?"
"Gave them to the lion,"
Evan said. "Oh." From 2 sicarios and 41 men to 1 sicario and 38 men. Progress. The more Evan could manipulate Montesco into killing his own men, the fewer Evan would have to contend with on his way out. "There might be more," Evan said. "Sleep with your door locked, gun under the pillow. Only your most trusted men at your side. Have darling boy keep prying into every employee. If Jovencito was a snake in the grass, that means anyone else could be too." Montesco rubbed his eyes, screamed "Fuck!" into his palm as loudly as he could, the cords of his neck standing out. His voice was hoarse, desiccated.
"This is my paradise. If I can't relax here, where can I?"
"I'll get this taken care of for you," Evan said.
"How?"
"Jovencito's phone shattered in our fight, but I have a colleague who can trace any call after the fact."
"It's a piece of shit, Kyocera. We prepay so there's no call history, no nothing."
"She is a technological wizard."
"She?"
"A woman," Evan said, "but competent." A man like El Moreno would not be able to imagine how competent a 16-year-old girl like Joey Morales could be. Montesco nodded. "She's already tracked it to a number with a 909 area code. Evan lied. "San Bernardino." Montesco said,
"The third shooter."
"That's right. As we speak, she's charting the cell phone towers it last pinged."
"So you can triangulate location?"
"Advanced forward link trilateration," Evan said.
"Joey would have been proud."
Montesco frowned, impressed.
"Find him. Put him in the ground."
"That is what I plan to do. But..."
"What?"
"It's nothing. Speak." "Just something I noticed Jovencito doing before we left this morning."
"What?"
"He was eyeing the sewer grates," Evan said. and I noticed his vehicle slowed as we passed certain storm drains heading out to the freeway. Montesco's face tightened.
Those aren't all storm drains.
Those are disguised hatches for your escape tunnels, Evan said. I think he was
charting them.
To help plan a raid. An inside man, like they had in San Bernardino, Evan said.
I will have my men check all routes and tunnels in and out of here.
How can you know who to trust? Montesco rose, paced a tight circle. He opened his mouth again, head shaking, teeth bared, as if he were screaming. But he made no noise. The effect was unsettling. Evan waited. At last, those wide eyes lifted to him through the curtain of fallen hair arcing from that severe widow's peak.
What do I do then?
There's specific technology I want to use to scan the escape tunnels. Countermeasures I'd like to get in place. I'm talking the real shit they use in Gaza, not knockoff toy soldier garbage from Mexico City.
Fine, Montesco said. How much?
One more of those should do.
Evan jerked a chin at the rolling suitcase on the luggage rack, packed with $100,000. My procurement guy is in South Texas. I'll drive there to put in an order, then fly to L.A. to take care of business.
You'll have your pick of my vehicles.
No, Evan said. Not with the Gulf Cartel waiting out there. Going in one of your cars is too conspicuous. I saw a Hertz at the edge of the city. Have one of your men drop me there. I'll handle the rest of my arrangements.
Fine. When will you leave?
As soon as I've showered off Jovencito's blood. At this, Montesco smiled that wide, loose smile.
You and me. We are carnales.
He offered Evan a hand to clasp and yanked him in for a one-arm embrace. The stench coming off him was powerful, but Evan, covered with dried sweat and blood, wasn't one to talk. As they pulled apart, Evan said, "Can I have my gun now?" Montesco considered this a moment. "I thought you might ask." He reached into the back of his waistband, held out the Aries 1911 to Evan. As Evan took it, the muzzle swept across Montesco's chest for a moment. Short-term temptation. Long-term disaster. He knew his pistol like it was a part of his body. He felt its heft and understood right away. Pretended to check and notice for the first time. "No bullets," he said. Montesco tapped Evan's temple a few times, hard enough that his fingernail pinched the skin.
"You just said I can't know who to trust."
He reached out and took the gun back.
"I trust you, Caballo Oscuro, because you are like me. This is also why I don't trust you. You see?"
"Fair enough.
Bring me the head of the third shooter.
Then we will see about allowing you a weapon under my roof." He slapped Evan not so gently on the cheek and withdrew. The sun was setting as Evan stepped out onto the portico. He wheeled a hard-shelled carry-on suitcase with each hand, the most valuable luggage he'd possessed in some time. The chauffeur named Raudel waited in one of the SUVs. Spotting Evan, he hopped out and loaded the suitcases into the cargo hold, then held the rear door for Evan. He climbed in, gazed across at the jailed row of human beings, another commodity waiting to be shipped out. Soulful eyes, gaunt cheeks, bruised arms from rough handling. They had a few more days of captivity before being moved along the assembly line. At the next stop, they'd be treated like product, like possessions, like meat, used once all the way through, or thousands of times until they wore out. He had to wrap this mission up before the shipping date that would consign them to an unknown fate. As the chauffeur walked around the SUV, a voice called out from the blind spot. "Hold on." A form flashed past the tinted window, and then Raimundo got into the driver's seat.
"Mind if I drive you?"
Evan shrugged. Raudel tapped the driver's window with a knuckle, and Raimundo rolled it down. The chauffeur took Evan's measure. He was a squat, barrel-chested man with a manicured beard. Even from here, his breath smelled of chewing tobacco. He spoke in heavily accented English.
I don't think you should be alone with these, Gabacho. I'll keep an eye out.
Raimundo drove off, leaving the chauffeur standing in the quartz stones, head tilted, looking befuddled. Evan called up the white noise app on his phone, placed it on his thigh. Raimundo took note, his eyes flashing in the rear view.
Gabacho, Evan repeated.
He's one of Darling Boy's buddies?
Most of them are, Raimundo said. My father has relied on Darling Boy for many years.
Why are you driving me?
I wanted to tell you.
Raimundo hesitated.
I'm grateful. To you.
For what you are doing for Angelina.
She told me about the hospital.
Not just that you protected her, but that
you comforted her.
I haven't. His voice wavered and he paused to regain his composure.
I haven't been able to protect her. Not like I should.
How about the other women? In the chicken coop? Raimundo's voice came low, like a little boy's.
I haven't been able to protect them either.
For a time, they drove in silence. Wind howled through the rock walls, an ungodly sound, the force strong enough to blow the SUV around on the road. At last, they sped out onto the valley, the highway stretching ahead like an arrow pointing to the broken city of Guaridon. The air conditioning blew cool and steady against Evan's face. He tasted stale cigar smoke seeping up through the leather upholstery. Everything the dark man touched carried his scent.
For as long as I can remember, Raimundo said, I prayed to God to take him away.
Not kill him, but just take him away. My hands sweat every time he walks into the room. My heart rate jumps when I hear his voice. Even when he's not there, I hear it thundering in my head. To fear the person who was supposed to protect you most, the person who brought you into the world. His voice was rising, but he caught himself. Now I no longer pray to God to take him away. I pray to God that he will die. If I can figure out how to give you a fresh start, are you ready to do anything you need to do to protect Angelina?
Yes.
Even if that means leaving and never coming back. Especially if it means that. But the tires rolled across the gritty asphalt, and then the SUV bounced off the exit, burrowing beneath an overpass, the cavernous space crammed with homeless encampments.
What if I screw this up?
She loves me now. But she's giving everything up. Everything. You are too, Evan said.
What if she decides it wasn't worth it?
That I'm not worth it? Make it worth it. Every day.
How do I do that?
Pay attention.
To what?
Everything. The city was desolate. Decrepit high-rises, few cars on the street, sporadic packs of roving boys. They stopped at a red light, the Hertz rental place waiting across the intersection. Chain link and barbed wire protected the collection of shabby vehicles. Evan would refuse the first two they offered in case El Moreno had made arrangements to bug them, and then he would choose the ugliest vehicle on the lot. An elderly blind man stood at the sidewalk, tapping his walking stick along the edge of the curb. He tentatively stepped down into the crosswalk, brown polyester pants tugging up at the ankles to show black socks and strips of dry, cracked skin.
No one ever taught me, Raimundo said, how to be a good man. I grew up with killers and whores.
When the light changed, he didn't roll off the line, though there was plenty of time for him to clear the intersection. Instead, he waited for the old man. In slow motion, the elderly man tapped along in front of them, feeling his way with the walking stick, avoiding a pothole and then a spill of shattered glass. He wore dark shades, his skin sun-burnished the color of walnut. Evan couldn't help but think of Belicia, all those wrong turns that led to her sights being robbed. and how she and Aragorn, despite all their suffering or because of it, seemed to have discovered deeper places within themselves. Evan leaned forward, pointing past Raimundo's shoulder at the blind man. "What's he doing?" Raimundo watched a moment. "Seeing where to walk?" "No. Seeing where he shouldn't walk." From the other side of the crosswalk, the blind man turned his face back to them, doffed an imaginary hat, and kept on his instinctive way. "That's where to start," Evan said. "Sometimes, that's all we have." Chapter 45. Up in Smoke. After 2 days inside the torture palace, a lethal brawl in a surgical suite, and the 3.5-hour drive back to Eden, Evan was in no mood for security theater. Special Ed and Kiki, manning the front gate of Aragorn's compound with a few PMCs, alerted as Evan pulled up in an overheated Chevrolet Matisse. He'd hidden the suitcases of cash in the spare tire compartment, crossing the border tensely but without incident. Slinging their AR-15s, the two men ambled up on either side of the cramped hatchback.
"Ah, look who came crawling home," said Eduardo. "Thanks to you, Patron is burning more product at the northeast end of the compound. Day and night he destroys his business. Un chingo de lana up in smoke. Wait here while we—" Evan said, opened the gate. Something in his face made clear he needed to see Aragorn immediately. The men stared at him a moment, and then Kiki lifted a radio to his face and mumbled into it. The gate retracted behind the concrete block wall, and Evan accelerated into the compound. A few shouts behind him as the two lieutenants hopped into a jeep to follow. The sky was a confusion of dark and light, the fallen sun throwing a cold gray glow from below the horizon, illuminating the firmament. After the tacky extravagance of Montesco's estate, Aragorn's land seemed downright homey. Dirt and generators and a normal suburban residence plopped down in the center. As Evan blazed to the house, a number of other vehicles came visible, raising trails of dust in the gloaming. They vectored toward him from the perimeter, spokes of a wheel converging. Clearly the alarm had been raised, the nowhere man returning with news of the imperiled daughter, and all the manpower of the compound was assembling for the update. Evan reached the front of the house, the other vehicles irising in on him and parked by the driveway. A jeep careened up, Aragorn hopping out while it was still moving, nearly stumbling as he ran for Evan.
"Where is she? Is she alive?"
Aragorn's shirt was unbuttoned at the top, showing off the sunburned skin of his chest. "She's alive," Evan said, "but there's more. And you're not going to like it." Aragorn stormed to Evan even as the other vehicles slanted into place, headlights skewering them, the front of the house. Men unpacked, doors slamming, breath huffing in the semi-darkness. Across the manicured front lawn, the door clicked open, Latia visible behind the screen. The air carried a tinge of acrid smoke, probably from whatever hall Aragorn was incinerating at the periphery. Aragorn charged as if to barrel straight through Evan, but he halted just in time, chest heaving.
"What? What is it? Tell me where she is!"
"She is with Raimundo, El Moreno's son. She went there by choice. She is being held captive now. And—" Aragorn looked confused, the meaty flanges of his nose flaring. That thick shock of black hair looked grayer, though it had been less than 72 hours since Evan had seen him.
"What?" Aragorn snarled. "What?"
"She's pregnant." Aragorn staggered as if shot, one hand clamped to the spot where his shoulder met chest. The screen door banged, and then Latia drifted across the lawn, nightgown fluttering about her ankles, not walking toward them so much as gliding. Aragorn's voice came low now, little more than a growl.
"What did you say? What the fuck did you just say?"
"Angelina is pregnant, with Raimundo's child."
"No. No!
Fury cut with disbelief, even a hint of pleading. It's not true.
Headlights stabbed Evan's eyes, but he did not look away. Aragorn's gaze was feral, murderous. Baring his teeth, he doubled over as if heaving, and a bellow escaped him. More a roar than a yell. His cheeks trembled.
The others had gathered around them in a loose circle, giving them space. Special Ed and Kiki were a half step in front, but frozen in their boots, locked to the ground, stunned by the sight of their boss in this state.
Aragorn straightened back up.
She lied to me?
She staged this?
That ungrateful...
His face looked to be tearing itself apart.
With them. The Leones? El Moreno's son? She has his bastard seed in her belly.
He flung a hand toward the rise of black smoke to the northeast.
For her, I'm burning down my kingdom.
For your daughter?
Yes.
Aragorn thundered at him, teeth clenched, veins popping in his neck.
This is worse than if she was dead.
You don't mean that.
Don't you dare tell me what I mean right now.
Your daughter, she can be anything she wants to be.
Anything! Except this.
You'd rather she were dead?
Yes. Yes. I'd rather my daughter was dead than a fucking whore.
Evan cuffed him. Open-handed, but hard. A thunderclap to Aragorn's left cheek. It caught him off guard, toppling him. He landed on one knee, head lowered, hair shielding his eyes. His shoulders heaved with his breath.
For a moment there was no sound save Aragorn's labored breathing. The men around them were paralyzed, in absolute shock. For once, Special Ed and Kiki held their tongues. Their eyes were shiny, and beneath the facial hair and acne scars and cover-up and raw-boned glares of killers, Evan could see the boys they had been, and for a single bright moment none of them were killers and cartel leaders and private military contractors and ex-government assassins, but just men beneath an open sky, enacting an ancient ritual they could comprehend, but scarcely understand. Eduardo reached for his pistol and started to step forward, but Kiki caught his eye and gave him a slight shake of the head. This was not for them. Aragorn rose with dignity, wiped his mouth. He walked quietly out of the ring of men. They parted, and he passed his aunt, standing barefoot in the grass. He opened the door, closed it gently behind him, and the night was still.
Chapter 46. Another Arrogant Gringo Pendejo. Latia stood glowering at Evan, her nightgown rippling around her in the breeze. Then she turned and followed Aragorn inside. The instant the door closed, the sound of their shouting carried outside, rapid-fire Spanish, too fast for Evan to understand. The others looked at him, unsure what to do. After a few minutes, the door hinged open. Latia skewered Evan with a glare.
"Get in here!"
Not a request. He went. Slack-jawed and stupefied, the men parted for him as well. The house smelled of onion and cilantro, a pot simmering on the stove. Aragorn was pacing around the ground floor like a raging bull, heat emanating off him, muttering low to himself, sweeping his shiny black curls off his forehead again and again. Latia's arms were crossed, head drawn back. Somehow, miraculously, she was wearing makeup. With her nut-brown skin and white hair, she was as imposing a figure as any Evan had encountered.
"You disrespect my sobrino," she said, "on his land, in front of his men."
"He disrespects himself."
"You know nothing of our family, nothing of our culture. Another arrogant gringo pendejo sticking your nose into something you scarcely understand."
"I understand that right now his image of his daughter is more important to him than she is." In the kitchen, Aragorn cursed and swept his arm, knocking the cast-iron pot off the burner, caldo de res splattering the wall. He slammed the heels of his hands onto the counter, shoulders pinching up into his neck, a pained, guttural noise escaping him.
His daughter, my granddaughter, has standards to live up to. A family name. This decision she made, it's unconscionable. Those people, the leones, are animales. And she chose to go to them, to be unsafe, to have relations before marriage, and above all, the lion, to us, putting lives at risk, inviting them here, into Eden, to raid our very own community. I don't disagree. And yet you dare to lay hands on her father?
Latia came at Evan, jabbing a manicured finger.
He has every right to put you 6 feet in the earth. He should stop.
A low feminine voice from the top of the stairs, clear as glass, sharp as a scalpel. Latia halted. Belicia stood at the landing, top lit by a recessed overhead. Despite the hour, she was fully dressed. Evan imagined her up there hearing the commotion, pulling on her jeans, buttoning her blouse, brushing her hair by feel alone. Her bearing was erect, shoulders pulled back and down, the picture-perfect posture of a gymnast or a drill sergeant. She reached for the railing, her fingers wavering over the wood before her palm cupped the top. She descended. In the full light, she was radiant. Reaching the bottom of the stairs, she halted, hand on the newel post. Her ghostly eyes took the measure of the room. She turned to Latia, her angle only barely wrong.
Enough, Latia said. If you'd heard the tone this man took with...
I heard everything, Belicia said.
Then you have to know.
I don't have to know anything.
This is between me and my husband.
Those sightless eyes turned to Evan, and he could have sworn she saw him as well as anyone ever had, if not better.
And the Nowhere Man.
Latia's mouth pursed, etched lines contracting. Then she dipped her chin deferentially and walked past Belicia and up the stairs. All this time, in violation of the first commandment, Evan had assumed that Latia was the materfamilias.
He'd assumed wrong.
Belicia drifted into the living room and sat in the leather armchair Aragorn had commanded a few nights before. She nodded at the couch, and Evan crossed the small room and sat. Aragorn stayed in the kitchen, out of sight, his fuming palpable.
Aragorn,
she said quietly, and then, a touch louder, Mi vida. Aragorn flew into sight.
Don't you dare try to talk me into accepting this. That child, your daughter, she had everything. Everything. She lived a perfect life.
In the face of Aragorn's fury, Belicia's calm demeanor was even more pronounced.
Behind these gates, she had everything she could possibly want. Every freedom in the world, every luxury. Wake up in the morning in a soft bed. Turn on a tap and fresh water pours out. Come downstairs. Drink coffee with beans picked where? Kenya? The shaded Pinche slopes of Guatemala. Shipped here, to our house. Our normal, fancy house.
Aragorn paced before her on the carpet, reminding Evan of Montesco's caged lion. How many bars of soap do we have under the sink? How many boxes of pasta in the pantry?
You don't know, do you? Neither do I. Because we don't have to. Because we are living the actual dream.
Those are things, Belicia said soothingly, as if to a child.
Okay. What were her responsibilities? Her only job, to better herself with school. To learn. To paint. Or to play piano. To flourish. To be loved. No, not just loved. Adored. Adored by us. It's not about her chores? What?
She took out the trash once a week, just so we could think of something for her to do.
Aragorn was shouting at his wife, Evan to the side, forgotten. Think of the slums of Nesa Chalkoitsa, 45 minutes by car from where you grew up. 80,000 people per square kilometer. Disease, starvation, drugs. No fresh water. 7-year-old children raising their younger siblings. Dirt floors, living in sheds. Cages no bigger than dog kennels. Belicia said,
Walk to school both ways in the snow.
Don't you dare patronize me right now. At this moment,
words, words, words,
Belicia said, and talk. So much talk, and not about anything that matters. That's what men do, yes?
I am warning you, Belicia.
Aragorn's voice trembled with rage, and in the set of his features, Evan could see the fearsome man who'd built a worldwide criminal enterprise. But Belicia continued, undeterred.
Aragorn, mi vida, if you are half the man you tell everyone you are, you would close your mouth and listen to what you don't know.
But he blew right past her, resuming his tirade. She could travel anywhere, pick a man she loved. How many people, how many girls in the history of the world have been allowed such freedom?
It was perfect here.
She had paradise. Evan said, maybe that's why she did it. Aragorn stared at him, his mouth literally agape.
I grew up like you, Evan said. We ground our way out. Maybe she had nowhere to grind, to learn about herself, the world.
Maybe this is what she had to do, to find her way to herself.
You don't even know her.
Maybe not. But I've met her. And I've met Raimundo.
Don't you speak that fucking name under my roof.
And he's a decent kid. Which says a lot, given where he came from.
You're not a father. If you were, you'd understand that you have to be merciless in this world to be good.
You think I don't know about being merciless? Evan said quietly. Aragorn's hands, clenched loosely at his sides, swayed. He stared at Evan, stooped, one shoulder higher, his complexion ruddy. He looked punch-drunk, unmoored.
You also have to know when to be kind,
Belicia said to Aragorn. It's the hardest thing a man can ever learn.
And most of them never do.
Aragorn swung his head to his wife. Some of the heat had bled out of him, but his tone was still bitter.
What would you have me do? Everything you need to know.
You know already, Belicia said. It just comes down to if you're going to listen.
I am listening, Belicia.
No, she said. You are shouting, so you don't have to. Aragorn's eyes were flared. Lots of white, his face flushed as if he'd just finished a sprint. He looked on the verge of losing control, but his words came softly now, even gently.
Tell me then, he said. What do you want me to understand?
You love that child more than anything on this earth, Belicia said.
Including me.
His face quavered.
And she has broken your heart, she continued. A father's love for a daughter. How strong is it? What's she worth to you? Not as a thing to preserve, but as your daughter. Our Angelina. Beyond it all. Beneath her foolish choices and our reputation and what she has risked so blindly and callously. Do you love her down to the marrow?
His mouth bunched. He moved his head very faintly. Up, down. Somehow, Belicia noted this.
Then should God grant us the blessing of being with our girl again?
The only thing to say to her is what you just said to me. Belicia paused, wet her lips.
What do you want me to understand?
Aragorn exhaled, truly exhaled, for what seemed the first time since Evan had entered the house. His muscles came loose, shoulders melting away from his ears, neck untensing, a landslide of movement. And yet he had barely budged. And then he was sobbing. Great, wet, gasping sobs, shuddering his frame. Evan had the sudden sense that he was observing something intimate, something he was not meant to see. And yet neither husband nor wife seemed embarrassed by his presence, and they did not ask him to leave. Hand over his eyes, Aragorn staggered forward like a blind bear.
I know, mi vida.
Belicia held out her arms.
I know.
He fell to his knees before her, collapsing into her, clutching around her midsection, face buried in her stomach. And he wept.
Chapter 47. Far from fucking okay. Aragorn's Jeep Wrangler blazed across the craggy terrain of the compound, the sash of the passenger seatbelt locking across Evan's torso. Evan found something soothing in the rough drive, bouncing him along across the earth, rocking him soporifically. Aragorn presided over the wheel with a confidence just shy of reckless. They'd endured the drive thus far in silence. They passed between burning pyres, black smoke wafting through the open cabin. It looked like the aftermath of a battle, which in a sense it was. Hundreds of millions of dollars of drugs aflame, an empire in ruin. It remained to be seen what would rise from the ashes. 20 minutes prior, Evan had retreated upstairs for a shower and a change of clothes, leaving Aragorn and Belicia to regroup. When he'd returned, bags packed and ready to go, the energy between the couple was different, softer, more vulnerable, like flesh freshly healed.
You hit like it, girl, Aragorn finally said.
Evan smirked. That was a slap.
If I'd punched you, you'd still be lying in your front yard. Between my aunt and my wife.
It's like getting pecked to death by ducks, Aragorn said. Sounds like you got where you needed to get.
With Belicia, yes.
She is like a divining rod for bullshit.
The best women are.
And what can we say in the face of that?
I'm sorry that my deficiencies have caused you pain. I'm grateful that the pain you were willing to endure led me to a greater awareness for myself.
Aragorn laughed, shook his head. That is the awful, beautiful, sacrificial power of love. We sharpen ourselves against those we love in order to cut ourselves open and see what's inside.
Sometimes I wonder if wisdom is nothing more than shortening the time before you realize how ignorant you are about something.
They rocked up a rise, the Wrangler jogging severely, the plain of the east end of the compound coming into view. It boasted a private runway with a Cirrus Vision jet. At a hair under $2 million, it was the cheapest private jet. But it sure as hell beat commercial, and allowed Evan to skip subjecting $200,000 of carry-on to a security check.
Humility, Evan said.
Yes.
And the thing about humility is, you never have it. You have to earn it every day. And every single time you embody it, you're tempted away from it. Just take a little more credit. Feel a little bit superior. Angle that light you're shining a tiny bit more on yourself and a tiny bit less on the truth you're searching for.
You're okay with Angelina? Evan asked.
No, Aragorn said. I am far from fucking okay.
But I am connected with her again.
In my heart.
If I can manage to bring her here, Evan said. If I can convince her to come. You'll let her make her own choices.
No,
Aragorn said.
But Belicia will convince me, and I will reluctantly listen.
And Raimundo?
Aragorn's jaw set. Get them here. And I won't castrate him. That's as far as I'm willing to go right now. No castration, Evan said. I'll see what I can do. How are you going to get her out? I'm not sure yet, Evan said, but I need a wide array of weaponry and top-shelf gear. I can get you whatever you need here. No, Evan said, even you can't do that. They drove parallel to the runway now, the ground at last smooth and flat beneath the rugged tires. I can't take a run at Montesco's estate, Evan said, not directly. I'll need to get back inside and see about getting her out. Them. Getting them out. I'll have to get them clear of the area, and then I'll need someone standing by for extraction. You'll have my best men. A team of trained private military contractors should be sufficient if Evan could escape the estate and surrounding area. The dangerous part would be starting at the heart of Montesco's realm and fighting his way out. I'll send you coordinates once I'm close, Evan said. Aragorn skidded to a halt, the river of dust from their wake mingling with smoke, blowing past the windows. The landscape turned apocalyptic. Evan started to climb out, but Aragorn rested a hand on his leg, halting him. As she grew up, Aragorn hesitated, cleared his throat. I loved that child so much. Like an ache. It was odd to see him so hesitant, working out his words in advance. I got so afraid for what the world might do to her that I pushed her toward the very thing I feared most. I didn't realize it, but now I do. My part in her asinine, self-destructive decisions. And for me to get here, for me to see, she needed to break me the way she did. It's all so jodido. You can't see unless you let go of everything you think you know, Evan said. Maybe that's all faith is, Aragorn said. Whatever you tell yourself to not be controlling. Evan climbed out and headed for the plane. Hey! He turned back. Aragorn rested his elbow on the ledge of the windowsill, looking across the V of his elbow. Bring my daughter home to me. He drove off before Evan could reply. The dedicated pilot waited at the top of the rolling set of steps, framed by the clamshell door next to the fuselage. Welcome aboard, Mr. Nowhere Man. Evan ducked to climb aboard. No flight plan. Nothing in the logbook. Fake tail numbers only. As discussed. The pilot eased into the cockpit, clicking a few of the overhead switches. Where to? Evan settled into the bolstered executive seat in the front row. I need to visit an old friend in Vegas. Chapter 48. One Unsanctioned Individual. When Evan rambled up to the ostensible auto repair shop at the edge of a desolate desert road on the outskirts of Vegas, he was greeted with the sound of gunfire. That was generally the sound around here, though Evan had never shown up at 6 in the morning before. He parked his third rental car of the week in front of the low-slung building and climbed out. Aragorn's pilot was standing by back at the Henderson Executive Airport. Evan knew to show up here alone. Wheeling his carry-ons on either side of him, he picked his way through the engine blocks, tires, and car bodies that formed an automotive garden of sorts in the scrubby brush that passed for a front yard. The gunfire was coming from the rear, so he moved past the heavy metal door, dodging the sightlines of the surveillance cameras and easing along the side of the building. Behind the auto repair shop facade, there were no lifts or oil pans or vehicles requiring new brake pads. Instead, there were crates of mortars and select files, specialized drill presses, lathes, mills, Dremels, welders, CNC machines, and threading dies to make customized weaponry. and all stripes of ammunition, from armor-piercing to wad-cutters. It was an old-fashioned armorer's lair, part lab, part dungeon, where one of Evan's most trusted contacts developed ghost weapons for numerous sanctioned Black Ops groups, and for one unsanctioned individual known by code and letter. As Evan neared the corner, he caught a whiff of cigarette smoke, then heard a few more snaps of gunfire, the sound of shattering glass, and a three-pack-a-day voice singing surprisingly on key. "Stand, Navy, out to sea, fight our battle cry. We'll never change our course, so vicious foe steer shy, aye. Tommy Stojack reclined in a retro aluminum lawn chair with fraying multicolored straps sun-faded to varying shades of bleached yellow. Roaring the Navy's march song, he used what looked like a ray gun from a 1950s science fiction movie to fire at a half-dozen empty Jack Daniels bottles lined on a flat rock about 15 yards away. "Roll out the TNT, anchors away!" Six bottles of the Tennessee Sour Mash had already met their maker, reduced to puddles of glass. A nearly empty bottle rested at Tommy's side, and he picked it up, snugging it beneath his bulbous nose to lips framed with a biker's horseshoe mustache. The movement brought Evan into his peripheral vision, and Tommy lowered the bottle, grinning wetly. "Tommy," Evan said, "got started early this morning?"
"It ain't early, brother. It's just past late."
When Tommy spoke, the camel wide bobbed in his mouth as if stapled to his lower lip. "Been a while."
"Yeah, well, time flies when you're in a coma."
Evan drew nearer. "Is that a Borchardt C-93?
"Look at you knowing a thing or two. Not bad for a mouth-breathing trigger puller."
Tommy raised the pistol to the incipient sunlight, admiring it.
"First commercially successful 9mm semi-auto. Saw light of day in 1893. Every last one hand-built and hand-fitted. Rough as a corn cob, but hell, if you know what you're doing, you can make it go bang. Took me all day to refurb this pea-shooter for a fancy-pants collector who needs every piece in his collection to be functional, 'cause rich people. That's why I figured me and Mr. Daniel here would have a celebration. Suck down a couple of bottles of loudmouth and see what shakes loose."
Visibility was low, daybreak threatening, but Tommy lifted the bizarre gun, sighted, and knocked off the next bottle. The two-piece arm of the toggle lock flexed on the recoil, flinging an empty cartridge from the breech. The pistol and ammo were not made for accuracy, but no one had told Tommy Stojack that. "Been shooting all night?" Evan asked.
"Yep. Had a lady drop by in the wee hours. Needed a tire changed. Found me out here. Poor gal looked like she'd stumbled in on Caligula in the boudoir."
It would be shocking, finding a Roman emperor in an 18th-century French bedroom.
"Don't annoy me with your book learning."
"What did you do?"
"Changed her damn tire. I ain't gonna leave no damsel in distress."
Evan lowered himself into the rusting lawn chair beside Tommy. The webbing had frayed, vinyl points poking into him like needles. Tommy slung the bottle Evan's way, brown liquid sloshing inside.
"Want a nip?"
"No, thanks."
"Let me guess. Nothing but that fancy fruity vodka can touch your pristine lips."
"Yep. Fancy fruity vodka."
"What is it you drink again?"
"I'm tired of talking about alcohol this week."
"Ain't that a first?"
Tommy sucked another lungful of smoke, shot it out through the gap in his front teeth, and then spit tobacco juice between his boots. He had a nicotine patch on his neck, two on his arm, and one on the back of his shooting hand. His other hand, the left, was missing a finger. Or more precisely, half a finger. One of many arcane injuries he'd accrued sometime in his early Spec Ops days. After Evan's penthouse had blown up, He'd stayed with Tommy for a few nights as they arranged the early stages of the rebuild. They'd been the oddest of odd couples, the worst of roommates. Tommy washed dishes only before using them, stored clean laundry in the dryer, and used the bathtub for making moonshine. By the third night, Evan was sleeping outside, where at least the dirt was where it was supposed to be. By the fourth, his OCD drove him to a hotel on the strip. "How's Sugar Britches doing?" Tommy said. "That girl. Frankie?" Tommy knew her name. He was immensely fond of Joey, but refused to admit it. "Joey," Evan said. "She wants to go on a road trip. By herself. Dangerous world out there. That's what I'm trying to tell her. I mean dangerous world for everyone else if a girl like her gets turned loose. Give me a heads up if that one makes it out in the wild."